So I gave you a bit of a preview. And yes, I'm tackling the gorilla, the elephant, and whatever a leviathan looks like. So what is sin? As believers in Yeshua, we are confronted by this question. But do we really understand this question as I am posing it to you? It is a very simple question when you hear it. We tend to complicate, if not overcomplicate, our answer and thus our perception of what sin is. By definition, and this is man's definition, an immoral act considered to be a transgression against divine law. Not bad, yeah? Not bad. As I mentioned, this is man's definition. This is not what God is saying. An act that is immoral, that is a transgression of divine law. Put another way, in all its simplicity, not my words, but God's, at least through John. 1 John chapter 3, starting in verse 1. See what love the Father has lavished on us in letting us be called God's children. For that is what we are. The reason the world does not know us is that it has not known Him. Dear friends, we are God's children now, and it has not yet been made clear what we will become. We do know that when He appears, we will be like Him, because we will see Him as He really is. And everyone who has this hope in Him continues purifying himself, since God is pure. Everyone who keeps on sinning is violating Torah. Indeed, sin is the violation of Torah. It's that simple. I could stop here. I just told you what sin is. Yet if, for there not being so much confusion and conflation, that is the merging of two or more sets of information, texts or ideas, I would be able to end here. I have shared this premise before, and I believe it relates here as well. Both traditional Judaism and Christianity are guilty of violating the command, yet in different ways. Deuteronomy chapter 4, starting in verse 1. Now Israel, listen to the laws and rulings I am teaching you in order to follow them, so that you will live. Then you will go in and take possession of the land that Adonai, the God of your fathers, is giving you. In order to obey the mitzvot of Adonai your God, which I am giving you, do not add to what I am saying, and do not subtract from it. Within traditional Judaism, they added to Torah in so many ways, through the oral law, which today is known as the Talmud, compiled of 22 volumes of written material. And I'm not talking pamphlets. I'm talking books. The Mishnah, that is the oral law, and the Gemara, which is the commentary of the rabbis, has become so pronounced within Judaism that it is given more authority than Torah itself. While on the other side of the fence, Christianity, in one way, has subtracted from while also adding at the same time. And keeping in mind what they're adding and subtracting are not relatable. They're different. So in essence, you have alternating current going on within the church. Alternating current goes both ways. They're both adding and subtracting at the same time. So what do I mean by this? Many of you are familiar with the following statement. We are no longer under the law, we are under grace. Right there you witness subtraction. Yet by this premise, it is not just one mitzvah, but the whole Megillah, the whole scroll of the Torah. Yet add in such a way that it has been imparted that there are more commandments in the New Covenant writings, and I believe the number is 1,050, that they have significantly added to the mitzvot of God. that are compared to that of the Pharisees and the Torah teachers. So what's going on? Theology is no different than what Yeshua was confronting with the Pharisees and the Torah teachers. Yet if, in Deuteronomy 32:4, the rock, his work is perfect, for all his ways are just, a trustworthy God who does no wrong, he is righteous and straightforward. Yet if this is true, I know it's true, but I'm using the if, the conditional if this is true, then why the concerted effort on both sides of the fence to modify, adapt, and transform his words? Our actions have made something that is so straightforward into something so complicated. In some ways, I think it was for job security. Jokingly, they being the leaders, something so complicated that you need someone to navigate and thus interpret for the lay person in terms of what everything means. Hello, lawyers and tax accountants. Sound familiar? Consider the first actionable word of Deuteronomy 4:2. The key word that is actionable is obey. In the King James, it is keep. And this means to comply with, to submit to carry out. Time for your aha moment. The Hebrew word used here is shamar, with an R at the end. What's the root word of shamar but shema? And keeping in mind, when you look at some of the words associated with shamar, it's no different than shema. To properly hedge, to guard, to protect, to beware, to take heed, to keep, to observe, to preserve, and to regard. In other words, what are all these things but actions? We're to guard by doing. We're to guard by listening. We're to guard by hearing. I've already given away the next line of my sermon. So Shema and Shamar. Shema is the root of Shamar. And if you know anything about root words in Hebrew, one builds upon the root. So this word requires action and thus is not passive. That is without active response. So something that's passive does not require an action. Yet God's word requires action. Be doers, action of the word. We have added to God's mitzvot by including our thoughts as transgressions, based primarily on a single verse capturing Yeshua's words, for which I believe, understand, of his intent is lost in the cultural context of the time and what is prominent. So this one verse has in essence created a whole other aspect of what is believed that we are to do. I have seen it more often than not. Single verses quoted in order to convey a premise, yet absent of the context the verse was written in. Verses left out, understanding of the culture, and thus ignoring the premise by which his words are being spoken. Not to mention whom they have been spoken to. The verses, Matthew chapter 5, verses 27 and 28. You have heard that the fathers were told, do not commit adultery. But I tell you that a man who even looks at a woman with the purpose of lusting after her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. How many of you have had those words used upon you with regards to your thoughts? If you've thought it, you've sinned. You need to seek God for forgiveness. Even if you look upon a woman with such thoughts, thoughts. You have already committed adultery. Those are powerful words. And they were meant to be thought-provoking. Not based on how we understand it today. And yet within this sermon, Yeshua reiterates to the people who are hearing his words. This is roughly 10 verses before. Don't think that I have come to abolish the Torah of the prophets. I have not come to abolish, but to complete. Yes, indeed, I tell you that until heaven and earth pass away, not so much as a yod or a stroke will pass from the Torah. Not until everything that must happen has happened. So whoever disobeys the least of these mitzvot and teaches others to do so will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever obeys them and so teaches will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you that unless your righteousness is far greater than that of the Torah teachers and the Pharisees, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. Some of you are probably squirming in your chairs right now. What is Rabbi talking about here? Then what is Yeshua doing if he is not conveying that our thoughts can violate one of Adonai's mitzvot? I believe Yeshua is doing exactly what the rabbis of his time and thus of our time do as well. He's placing a fence around Torah. The term used for this is chumra, chumra. Chumrot, for plural, is a prohibition or obligation in Jewish practice that exceeds the bare requirements. So in other words, here's the minimum. Everything that is chumra or chumrot is over and above. What are they doing? They're adding to. One who imposes chumra on oneself is given the instant, is said to be a machmir. Didn't look up the word. I'll have to next time. The rationale for a chumra comes from Deuteronomy 22:8, which states that when one builds a house, he must build a fence around the roof in order to avoid guilt should someone fall off the roof. So what are they doing? They're taking a premise. If you build a house, put a fence on the roof. To God's word. This has been interpreted by many as a requirement to build a fence around Torah in order to protect the mitzvot. Is everybody with me so far? Again, an interpretation of a verse where its context is ignored and human understanding is infused. Yet I also believe the intent was in the right direction, yet got out of control. The fence became the house, in that it has become more important than the house itself. A second meaning of chumra is simply a stricter interpretation of the Jewish law. When two or more interpretations exist, okay, one says this, one says that, who do we follow? This meaning is closely related to the first meaning, because people who follow the more lenient interpretation believe that their interpretation is the baseline requirement of the law, and that the people who observe the stricter one are doing something extra. In other words, here's the bar. But if you want to get extra points, go here. However, people who observe the chumra in this sense believe that they are following the baseline requirement, and to do any less would violate halakha or Jewish law. So what am I doing here? I'm infusing you context, which was at the time of Yeshua and exists today. So what is an interpretation but our means to understand what is being conveyed? If there is more than one understanding, we see this in the times of the Pharisees prior to Yeshua, where the house of Hillel was more lenient and the house of Shammai was more strict. We see it with the Pharisees and the Sadducees. One believed this, one believed that. Thus, the implication of Qumrah here would be to follow that which was most lenient. It's like, okay, here, just do this. It's all you have to do. Yet if you do the more strict one, oh, well, you're doing well, you might get a star. Humor intended, by the way. What have believers done to themselves as they are taught such a premise about our thoughts being actionable, when in reality they're not? They have put back in place the heavy yoke that Yeshua removed. Come to me, all of you who are struggling and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, because I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. So we'll do away with the whole law. We'll have 1,050 commandments in the new covenant. And not only are we being judged by our actions, but we're being judged by our thoughts as well. Is that even not more of a heavier yoke than the law itself? Yeshua is establishing here that every action has an origin. The origin of every action is simple. It starts here. We do not do anything without first thinking about it. Thus, Yeshua is nipping the action in the bud of the mind, the origin of our actions. Had we understood what I believe Yeshua was doing here, we would not be placing so much guilt upon ourselves, let alone others. Likewise, I also believe that we would not be so judgmental or hypocritical either. We are not the thought police. We are his witnesses. Your focus, when confronted by such challenges pertaining to sin, to what sin is rather simple. First, is it actionable? Did you actually do something, not just think it? Consider this in two parts. What did God say? Not what is my interpretation, or what is someone else interpreting, but go back to the source. What did God say? What did God say about whatever you perceive your transgression to be? I go back to 1 John 3:4. I'm not minimizing anything for you. I'm helping you understand what is correct and what is implied. Everyone who keeps sinning is violating Torah. Indeed, sin is the violation of Torah. It's that simple. Yeshua spoke is the same as God said. Yet as I have shared, he neither added to nor subtracted from Torah. He did not come to do away with it and establish something better and different, but to amplify our understanding of it. Second, where is it written? When you're confronted by someone who says, well, what you're doing is wrong, based on God's perspective, where is it written? Starting in the first five books, where is it written in the five books? Sin is found in Torah. It's identified in Torah. Anything else is related to that. This isn't anything radical I'm saying. Yet, what has happened? So much has been infused into us. Another fence is being placed between us and God. So many more things that he never even said, that he's silent about. Well, that's immoral. Okay, maybe it's immoral in culture and humanity. Likely it's immoral because God said it's immoral. But the question is, did God say? What did God say? And where is it written? We have seen in the New Covenant writings, Yeshua and his Talmidim utter when speaking, it is written, whether in Torah, the Tanakh, or the prophets, 16 times. Thus, there must be something important to know about that which is written. Keep this in mind. God does not contradict his word. I've shared this with you before. If you see a contradiction, it's not him, it's you. Theology is the contradictive essence. What is theology? Our interpretation of his word. Point two, Yeshua does not contradict God's word. He's not saying something different that contradicts what was written. He is the word that became flesh and dwelt among us. He existed before the foundation of the earth. Yet we confuse God's word because we are taught incorrectly. We do have our challenges as believers in Messiah. We have our old nature to contend with, while our new nature resides within us as well. Romans 8, 5 through 8. For those who identify with their old nature, set their minds on the thing of the old nature, but those who identify with the Spirit, set your minds on the things of the Spirit. Having one's mind controlled by the old nature is death. What are we talking about? Mind. The mind. Shaul is talking about the mind controlling our actions. Having one's mind controlled by the old nature is death. But having one's mind controlled with the Spirit is life and peace. For the mind controlled by the old nature is hostile to God. But it does not submit itself to God's Torah. Indeed, it cannot. Thus, those who identify with the old nature cannot please God. Does it get any simpler than this? Yet it is not our thoughts that condemn us, it is our actions. Might I say that Shaul is a treasure trove in Romans? Therefore, and this is Romans 7, 7. Therefore, what are we to say? That the Torah is sinful? Heaven forbid. Rather, the function of the Torah was that without it, I would not have known what sin is. For example, I would not have become conscious of what greed is if the Torah had not said, thou shalt not covet. But sin, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment, worked in me all kinds of evil. All kinds of evil being worked up here. Agitating. Giving cause to anxiety or whatever social abnormality you want to consider. But sin, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment, worked in me all kinds of evil desires. For apart from Torah, sin is dead. I was once alive outside of the framework of Torah. But when the commandment really encountered me, sin sprang to life. Talk about enticement. Something forbidden is even more enticing. Sin sprang to life and I died. The commandment that was intended to bring me life was found to bring me death. For sin, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment, deceived me. And through the commandment, sin killed me. It's not the commandment that killed him. It's the realization that the commandment existed and his embracing of the transgression that killed him. So the Torah is holy. That is, the commandment is holy, just, and good. So whatever you're thinking about for the first, from verses 7 through 11, think again, because Shaul just contradicted everything that you might have been thinking about the negative aspect of how Torah is viewed. Shaul is talking about actions committed in the flesh, not thoughts committed in the mind. But he's amplifying that that's where everything originates from. Every command of Adonai is based on action, not thought-based. You're probably still wondering, well, where is he going with this? 2 Corinthians chapter 10, starting in verse 1. Now it is I myself, Shaul, making an appeal to you with the meekness and forbearance that come from Messiah. I who am considered timid when face to face with you, but intimidating from a distance. But I beg you not to force me to be intimidating when I am with you, as I expect to be toward some who regard us as living in a worldly way. For although we live in the world, we do not wage war in a worldly way. Because the weapons we use to wage war are not worldly. On the contrary, they have God's power for demolishing strongholds. We demolish arguments and every arrogance that raises itself up against the knowledge of God. And this is the key. We take every thought captive and make it obey Messiah. So in other words, whatever is going on in here does not come into the world, so to speak. So your thought cannot be an action. Because let me put it to you this way. If we're to be judged by our thoughts, the kingdom would be bare. When taking every thought captive simply means we do not act upon them should they violate one of Adonai's commands. Jeremiah conveyed the following words as Adonai was revealing Israel's transgression both as a people and as a nation. Jeremiah 17, 9 and 10. The heart is more deceitful than anything else and mortally sick. Who can fathom it? Well, he's a good person. Yet without Messiah, without the Ruach HaKodesh, there is a separation. I, Adonai, search the heart. I test inner motivations in order to give to everyone what his actions and conduct deserve. So God searches our heart, but also we're judged by our actions. We are given a new heart, not literal, but figurative. But we'll get a new one literally soon. That is in relation to him. For Adonai has written his words on this new heart. Ezekiel 36, 26 and 27. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit inside you. We're not just getting our engines rebuilt. We're getting them replaced. I will take the stony heart out of your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. I will put my spirit inside you and cause you to live by my laws, respect my rulings, and shamar, obey them. And thus we are to guard it, our heart. Philippians 4, 4. Rejoice in union with the Lord always. I will say it again, rejoice. Let everyone see how reasonable and gentle you are. The Lord is near. Don't worry about anything. I could stop there. Don't worry about anything. On the contrary, make your requests known to God by prayer, by petition, with thanksgiving. Then God's shalom, passing all understanding, will keep your hearts and minds safe in union with Messiah. And thus we should remember and thus do the following. And this should be familiar to everyone. My son, don't forget my teachings. Keep my commandments in your heart, for they will add to you many days, years of life and peace. Do not let grace and truth leave you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart. Then you will win favor and esteem in the sight of God and of people. Trust in Adonai with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, then he will level your paths. Not that I'm adding, if he will level your paths, he will give you peace of mind too. And thus we are empowered to understand through the Ruach HaKodesh, as conveyed by Yeshua in John chapter 14, starting in verse 25. I have told you these things while I am still with you. But the Counselor, the Ruach HaKodesh, whom the Father will send in my name, will teach you everything. That is, he will remind you of everything I have said to you. What I am leaving you with is shalom. I am giving you my shalom. I don't give the way the world gives. Don't let yourselves be upset or frightened. You heard me tell you I am leaving and I will come back to you. If you love me, you would have been glad that I am going to the Father, because the Father is greater than I. Thus, we have peace. Don't overthink. And don't overthink about thinking either. Sometimes we think about what we're thinking about, and then we overthink what we're thinking about. Focus on your actions and their relation to what is written in its context. Don't place an additional yoke upon you that has already been removed. Understand God's word in its own context and in the context of the people he chose to convey his light to the nations. If you do all these things, your walk will not be downtrodden, but victorious. I say all this to you because I have neither added to nor subtracted from his word what I have just shared with you. But I am instructing you as Shaul instructed Timothy. Here is a statement you can trust. 2 Timothy 2:11. If we have died with him, we will also live with him. If we persevere, we will also rule with him. If we disown him, he will disown us. If we are faithless, he remains faithful, for he cannot disown himself. Keep reminding people of this. Hello, I'm reminding you of this. Keep reminding people of this and charge them solemnly before the Lord not to engage in word battles. They accomplish nothing and nothing useful. And even worse, in his words, they are a catastrophe to the hearer. Look at them and what they're debating or arguing about. You can have a heated debate and not be an argument, but from someone else's perspective, look at them. They don't even agree on whatever. Fill in the blank. Do all you can, actionable. Do all you can, not what someone perceives, not what someone is dictating, but all you can within your power and your strength. Do all you can to present yourself to God, not to the church, not to your family, to God. If you present yourself in this manner to God, it will be reflected on whoever you present yourself to. Do all that you can to present yourself to God as someone worthy of his approval, as a worker with no need to be ashamed, because he deals straightforwardly with the word of truth. King James, he rightly divides. She rightly divides. Everything that I've been sharing with you is about rightly dividing, neither adding nor subtracting, but understanding. Yet the body of Messiah is suffering. It's in pain. It's self-inflicted pain. We're killing ourselves by trying to live for him, because we're placing an additional burden upon ourselves that he didn't even put on us. Well, I'm going to be more righteous because I'm going to do more. Yet God didn't ask you to do that. Why do more than what God is requiring that isn't even from God? God did not give you more that you had to do. He shared everything with you that is required of you. You're not going to get extra points. Well, I'm going to be even more righteous than his word. How is that even possible? So you ask, what is sin? I shared with you what sin is, but I also shared with you what the conflation that of the appearance of sin is not. I might go into more detail next week. I don't even know yet. Maybe I'll give you some examples. I have no idea. I'm not even there yet. Today's not even done yet. Shabbat's not even over. And my secret, because I've been thinking about this for a few days now and some things have occurred, and all of this was written first thing this morning. Every aspect of it. There was not a word on this page until 6 o'clock this morning. So, how do I say this? Don't take my word for this. Believe me, don't believe me. If you want to continue enabling your thoughts to think that you are sinning in your mind when you're not, I can't change that for you. But I will tell you that you're placing a greater yoke upon yourself. Why put a yoke on that he removed? Well, it looks good on me. Well, it's a piece of bling that I have that just looks good on me. I look good when I'm wearing my yoke and I'm miserable. Or I'm more critical on myself than other people are. Needless to say, he has given us peace. He has given us liberty. Yet why would we try to change that? Why would we try to misinterpret it? Because everything is there for our understanding. How people draw one conclusion based on verses without looking at the context of other passages is beyond me. How is that proper study? How is that proper learning? When you're isolating something and you're ignoring everything else around it. The thought that just came to me now is they study with their heads in the sand. They're ostriches. It's like, oh, well, nothing else matters. I'm protected. I'm in God's grace. Yet their little head, their little tiny head, is in the ground, and everything else is exposed. So some of it was light in nature, but some of it, again, like I said, don't put more upon yourself than God requires of you. It's not going to get you anywhere. It's not going to get you any further in the kingdom. Well, if I do more, I'll have a better seat. If I do more, well, maybe I'll be one of the 24. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the rationale is. Everyone comes from a different perspective. But what I'm sharing with you here is one that Torah is not a burden. God is not going to judge you for any more than he's already revealed. And there's nothing new in the new covenant, because everything affirms the Tanakh and Torah specifically. Even when he says, I give you a new command to love yourselves as I have loved you, is not truly new in a sense, it's just phrased differently. Love your neighbor as yourself. Well, I'm not your neighbor, I'm your Messiah, so as I love you, you're to love others. So, I mean, he's just inflecting God's love, which, nicely on the back of your bulletins. So keep these things in mind. And I will say this, don't leave it in your mind. Act upon it. Because action speaks louder than the words that you're creating in your mind before they're spoken. So everybody please rise.